This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2015, held at Faith Builders on August 4 through 7.
Okay, good morning. Let's go ahead and get started. It's good to have you here. I'm looking forward to a time of thinking together. I'd like to begin with prayer. Let's pray. Father, we ask you to be here present among us and direct our thinking today through your Spirit. Give us a heart to love you, a heart to and a will to follow you, to choose you. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Just a note about the handout that has been given out. I don't necessarily intend for you to follow that closely as we go through our material here today. That's more of a resource sheet for you to take with you and refer to later if you like. So I'm not going to be, don't intend for you to be glued to your worksheet or to the handout as we go through our material here. And also, one other note at the top of your handout, I have included my email address. That's so that as you reflect later, if you have feedback, questions, or input, feel free to email me and either ask for materials that I might refer to, or just give me your ideas, your feedback on any of the issues that you didn't get a chance to talk about in class here or in the workshop. I'm going to begin with a short video from a little speech by a guy named Ray Kurzweil. Is that a familiar name? You heard of Ray Kurzweil? Okay. He has some interesting things to say. It's probably controversial. So let's listen to it, and then we're going to talk about it. We're going to have some questions that we want to throw at him and get us thinking together. I'll give you just a little more information about Ray Kurzweil before we get started. He's currently the director of engineering at Google. He has quite a history of inventions and just technological developments. He's in the world of technology. Apparently, he's considered a real guru, a genius, actually, and a lot of people respect what he has to say, although he has his critics as well. But let's see what you think. It's just about a 3-minute clip here that we'll listen to, and then we'll talk about it.
Well, by 2020, we'll have computers that are powerful enough to simulate the human brain, but we won't be finished yet with reverse engineering the human brain and understanding its methods. One of my main themes, and I've developed this thesis over 30 years, is that information technology grows exponentially. The power of computers, our understanding of the human brain, the spatial resolution of brain scanning, the number of bits to move around the internet, I mean, many different measures of information technology double every 1 year, or every 11 months, 13 months, depending on what you're measuring. So these technologies will be a million times more powerful within 20 years. In fact, the speed of exponential growth is itself speeding up. So in 25 years, these technologies will be a billion times more powerful than they are today. And we've already seen that kind of progress. When I was an undergraduate, we all shared computer at MIT that's just a half a billion. The computer in your cell phone today is a million times cheaper and 1,000 times more powerful. That's a billion-fold increase in price performance of computing since I was an undergraduate. By 2029, and I've been quite consistent on this date, we will have completed the reverse engineering of the human brain. And we've already made very good progress on that. We've reverse engineered a number of different regions, like the cerebellum, which is responsible for our skill formation, and slices of the cerebral cortex where we do our official thinking, and the auditory cortex, the visual cortex, and so on. By 2029, we'll have reverse engineered and modeled and simulated all the regions of the brain, and that will provide us the software algorithmic methods to simulate, you know, all of the human brain's capabilities, including our emotional intelligence. And computers at that time will be far more powerful than the human brain. And we'll be able to create machines that really do have the subtlety and suppleness of human intelligence. And they'll combine that power with ways in which machines are already superior to us. They can harness all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. If you remember billions of things accurately, they can share knowledge at electronic speeds that are a million times faster than human language. So it'll be a very powerful combination. But the last point I'll make is that it's not some alien invasion of intelligent machines coming from Mars to invade us. It's coming from within our civilization. And the whole point of it is to extend our reach. Ever since we picked up a stick to reach a higher branch, we've used our tools to extend our reach. We can now already extend our reach mentally. I can take out a device from my pocket and access all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. Half the farmers in China have these devices and can do the same thing. It's spawning a real cultural revolution in China and around the world. And these tools are continuing to grow exponentially in power. The singularity is not just that point where we achieve human level of intelligence for the machine. I mean, that will start a new revolution where these machines will continue to grow exponentially in power. They'll be able to actually improve their own software design. By 2045, we'll have expanded the intelligence of our human-machine civilization a billion-fold. That will be singularity. And we borrow this metaphor from physics to talk about an event horizon that's hard to see beyond.
Okay, well, there's Ray Kurzweil and some of his ideas. He has lots more stuff. He's written extensively about this idea. When I shared some of this information with my students last year at school, 10th to 12th graders, they were ready to talk about it. This got them. They had a reaction to this. He talked about reverse engineering the brain, and let me just give you tell you a tiny bit more about what he means by that. He says, this is a printed article in which he talks about the same thing. He said, the most immediate way to reach this goal is by destructive scanning. Take a brain frozen just before it was about to expire and examine one very thin slice at a time to reveal every neuron, interneural connection, and concentration of neurotransmitters across each gap between neurons. One condemned killer has already allowed his brain and body to be scanned, and all 15 billion bytes of him can be accessed on the National Library of Medicine's website. So this guy is serious about what he's saying here. Unless you think that he is just somebody out on the very fringes of the society, like I said, he's the director of engineering at Google. That's kind of scary to me that he's at Google. But what's your reaction?
Is he saying by reverse engineering that the computers will be able to think and have all the functions of the brain?
Pretty much be an exact, yeah, have an the exact function of what the brain does. Mm-hmm. I think so. And, yes.
Mm-hmm. Along with that, I was doing some reading maybe a year or two ago about consciousness. They still have not located consciousness yet, and they think it's in the microtubules of the nucleus, you know, in the cell. It's not even in the synapse. So he's not even addressing that.
And he also is operating off the assumption that man is his own master, that there's no higher power that will ever possibly, there's no building thing that can stop man. He's saying, we can build a Tower of Babel, we can do whatever we want.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of his basic assumption, is kind of behind all that.
Okay, it's a Interesting to hear you bring up the word assumption. That's good. What else do you have? What else do you, how else are you reacting to what you're hearing here?
This reminds me of the clash you would have between the engineering or accounting departments and the human resources department. I mean, he's an engineer. He can replicate anything, but math concepts don't always work with people.
Another assumption he has is that we are biological machines, products of evolution, you can tell it.
Okay. So the nature of human beings, the nature of a human history, how it develops.
He referenced the stick.
Mm-hmm.
The real home stick out of his head and the beginning of the tools.
Yeah. That's right.
I wonder how he will reverse engineer the conscience.
I noticed that they're going to, you said something about starting with a killer. I'm a little concerned about that.
Okay, well, what are some of his assumptions? Let's just go ahead and dig a little bit deeper and try to uncover some of the assumptions he makes about a number of different things. And you've already brought it up. What does he assume about the nature of the human mind? It's entirely physical. It boils down to electrical impulses, right? Computers can do electrical impulses. All right, so that's the nature of the human mind. Then his project does seem more feasible, okay? What does he assume about what it means to be a human? Maybe we've already said this, but it's a biological, or a merely biological entity, a certain set of data, you could say. The course of human history, what guides, what controls the course of human history? What does he assume about that?
Mankind itself.
Okay. And what else could we say about what he's assuming with that? I think that's right.
That the exponential growth will continue to grow without limit.
Yeah, this is an actual graph that this guy Kurzweil put together, and you probably can't really see it, but he is projecting and basing his dates off of this particular graph. Will lead to the singularity that he was talking about. So there are a lot of assumptions on a graph like this. Yes, Brian.
What his earlier dates are there.
I might be able to see on the computer screen here. I think it goes back to around 1900, but I'm not sure about that. Might even be a little into the 1800s.
Yeah. One thing I'm not quite sure I totally understand as far as words, define what he's meaning for sure by the singularity. I think I understand that, but I'm a little fuzzy on exactly how to define that.
I think he means by singularity the point at which the human person can exist in the form of a computer, basically. He talks at other places about a radical life extension, is the term he used. Basically, eternal. And he says that he thinks that people will be able to basically take their person, get it into a body that's non-biological and continue to exist in that form. And he said he thinks that he's just on the edge. He's going to make it.
Download their brain into a machine and live it forever.
That's correct. And he said not only will there be radical life extension, there's going to be radical life expansion. it's interesting to hear him talk about how that there would be a profound philosophical problem with radical life extension without some kind of other expansion. So there would be boredom that would come. But he believes that there would be just endless expansion in not only time, but also in terms of sort of scope and ability to do things. It's interesting to see what all he's doing to make sure that he lives long enough before this technology becomes available. He's taking some 150 pills supplement a day. He gets IVs. He micromanages his levels and his blood levels and so on. He's working really hard to make it long enough to get into this.
Well, I bet God's laughing.
What is his age?
I think around 65, but I'm not sure exactly how old. Yeah.
This is very interesting because I just introduced my students to C.S. Lewis's book, That Hideous Strength, with the same thing. It seemed like, I don't know if you've ever read the book.
Yeah, I kind of forget how. And it's hideous.
Yes, because okay. It's demonic control.
Okay. Yes.
The other aspect of the singularity is that beyond that point, it's not even meaningful to try to predict what's going to happen.
Okay.
We
can't really see past it.
But what does that mean? It doesn't make sense for us to even try. We can't imagine that.
It's a completely new stage of history, not just human history, but history. Yeah.
Does he say how he plans to type? Okay, so say you can download your brain into a machine. Doesn't that just make a copy of yourself? How is he supposed to transfer your consciousness into something else?
Well, doesn't it go back to his assumptions of the nature of the human mind? That it is a certain set of data, and consciousness is an inherent part of that data.
But it seems like you'd be replicating yourself, not transferring the consciousness. Because even if you could take all the information, everything that's in your brain, and put it into something else, how does it transfer from you into a machine? You might be able to take all the data contained in your brain and put it in something else, but then you're still you. How do you get?
There would just be two of you at that point.
Yeah.
With separate sets of consciousness? Or would it be one with two
actors? Already, Facebook and Pinterest know what you're going to look at better than you do.
Yes.
I'd also like to ask this man if this is going to be possible. Why haven't humans figured out how to take a asphyxiated frog and bring it back to life? What is life?
What's the nature of life? What's his assumption about that? Okay.
Is that what he's going for, to try to extend life necessarily, or is this more like thinking all about what this could mean to the medical field and people with? Certain diseases or brain issues, people who've been in like extreme accidents. Like, what is his goal here?
Someone else maybe wants to respond to that. Do I not?
Isn't he assuming that the real you is your mind? That's who you are, and so if you can extend your mind, your body doesn't. Right.
Yeah, he does say at one point that our something, this is a more or less a quote, that our person does need a body. He says our intelligence is oriented toward a body, but it doesn't have to be a biological body. And so I think what he's saying is that this is just what's happening. It's not so much that he's out promoting it exactly. Although I think on one hand he's working to make it happen. He's saying this is the inevitable, this is the curve that we're on, and he's trying to describe the curve. And it's going to mean advances in the medical field, It's also going to mean, he definitely talks about radical life extension, where people can continue to exist. He says at one point that would be what we're about, is the trying to achieve what's good for the human race. And he said, what could be better than an extension of life? And so he doesn't see that as being the human good, is be able to continue to exist and live. Just a few more here. What does he assume about the purpose of life? Not sure that we've talked about that. What is the purpose of life? From what we can pick up and what he's saying.
He's saying the purpose of life is strictly to enhance human life.
Mm-hmm.
Based on his point there that, you know, with the computers being able to gain to the point to where they're better themselves.
Yeah. It's an egocentric, very much. It's self-centered. What's the purpose of life is the enhancement of my own enjoyment, certainly. What does he assume about man's origin? Yeah, it's the product of forces. It's evolutionary. It's trajectory. What does he assume about God? What do you think? At least that it's an irrelevant, he's an irrelevant concept, I think would be safe to say. So this was my attempt just to summarize what those questions: human mind is electrical impulses, being human is a certain set of data, human history is controlled by nature, the purpose of life is to enjoy ourselves for as long as we can, and as a product of natural forces, and God is irrelevant. It could be better ways to articulate those, but that's just a summary. And so once we get some of these assumptions unearthed, once we identify some of the assumptions that underlie his ideas and his actions, his ideas, we can begin to analyze them a little bit better and therefore form probably a more appropriate response in light of what we believe about his assumptions and how we assess his assumptions. So we could ask, are they true? We could start with that. Is it true that human mind is electrical impulses? Is it true that being human is a set of data? Yeah.
First one might be true in some respects. The second one, absolutely.
Okay. Maybe for the first one, neither one of those exactly says what personality is, although being human and having personality maybe is pretty close to being synonymous.
Are we convinced that the human mind and the brain are synonymous?
Okay, what does he assume about that? And are his assumptions true? And do our assumptions agree with that? That's a good question. Is it? We could just ask all of these. Do they match reality? Another way of asking the question: are they true? Okay, we could ask another question. We could ask: are they good? Right, that's looking at it from a little different point or reference point. Are they good? Some of the questions don't be hard to analyze others' work. Are they beautiful? Okay, that looks at us slightly, looks at it somewhat, looks at it from a different angle. Are they true? Are they good? Are they beautiful? Are they godlike? Are they worthwhile? And now, in light of how we answer those questions, we could begin to consider the more practical questions. So, what should our response be to this. When Google begins to offer free brain scans, are you going to sign up for it along with your Google Play, Google Drive, Google Maps, and everything else? So that's the practical. That's where it becomes practical. What should we do about this? What should we do to prepare ourselves for a push toward this direction? Kurzweil and people like him are working really hard on this kind of thing, and this is a passion for them. They're working hard to, I believe, bring about good for themselves and the human race from their perspective on what's good. We could ask ourselves, how am I investing my energies? Thing that you would just want to say about this quickly before we move on? Yes.
Well, I think one thing we need to remember is that even if it were possible to do that, he could still not be extending his life. He would just be extending his ability to do electronic impulses in his brain, because once he downloads his brain's impulses to a non-biological machine, he's no longer living. He's simply plastic or whatever. And if you, in order to extend your life or to enjoy your life, you have to be living, and if something's going to be living, it's going to have life, and it has to be biological. Like, other things cannot be living, and you know, one of the parts of living is to, if something's alive, it has to be able to reproduce. Well, and what would that be, copy and paste, or? So it wouldn't. He's no longer living at that point.
3D printer.
Yeah. Well, I think probably, you know, and the way you're defining the terms, that's true. He has different definitions and assumptions about what life is, and you know, that's what we've been talking about. And so you reveal your very different assumptions about reality. And that's what we're doing this because we're considering engaging worldviews, and we're not here to answer this question. This was something to get us going and an example of what we can do in our classrooms to try to get our students to consider, think about assumptions, analyze them, become critical thinkers. And to help them formulate Christian responses, understand Christian assumptions, Christian responses to what they encounter. I'd like to move on and talk just a bit about what we mean by worldview. I'm assuming that we have a fair amount of familiarity with this term, but just quickly give it a definition. Before we move on, Geisler and Watkins say that a worldview is a way of viewing or interpreting all of reality, the interpretive framework through which or by which one makes sense out of the data of life in the world. We're making sense out of the data in one way. Kurzweil was making sense out of it in a different way. And so when I say worldview studies in our classrooms, I simply mean the attempt to dig beneath the surface of life's experiences and to examine and then evaluate. Evaluate is more of a judging term, right? You place value on the assumptions that shape those experiences. What's the value? I'd like just to ask this question and consider it just a bit. What is the value of educating our students in worldviews to get them to engage with these issues like we were just doing and to think about them? I have a few ideas here, and I'll welcome your additions to these. One of goal or one value of doing this is that we want to train our students to be discerning shoppers in the marketplace of beliefs, attitudes, values, ideas. We live and our students live or growing up in an Amazon of ideas and attitudes and behaviors. If you shop on Amazon, you just have it's an amazing array of things at your fingertips that are trying to be sold to you. And our students and we are living in that kind of a world where we're surrounded with just an Amazon of ideas and values. And we want to help our students see that all of these different things, these values and ideas, aren't simply neutral. It's not neutral ground where that are sort of independent of moral values or that come without some kind of attachment to a basic worldview that's either true or not true, good or not good, or some mix of that. Help our students to learn just as a habit to see a connection between what certain behaviors and values and ways of doing things with basic assumptions about the world. There is a connection. There are underlying assumptions to these things that are being sold to them by the world they live in or being offered to them. Secondly, to help students see, among other things, that Christianity is a comprehensive worldview. And comprehensive is what I'm focusing on, wanting to emphasize in that it answers, it provides an answer in every category of reality. It's not that we are in nationality American, in economics, Keynesian, in politics libertarian, in technology Apple, and in spirituality Christian. Which there's people who operate that way, where Christianity is that plug-in for your spirituality, and in other categories you're something different. That's a distortion of the gospel. That's not Christianity. So we want to, and this isn't, I don't think worldviews is the only way we do this, but it's one of the ways we help our students see that it offers answers in every category, and it's comprehensive. Okay, number three, to also help students understand that some of the competing views of Christianity that are prevalent around us, to understand that there are competing views and what these competing views look like. And to help them see the inadequacies of these views, the negative consequences that come out of the alternatives to Christianity. They're not innocuous. They're not harmless. They have negative consequences. I'd like to make a note of clarification here in talking about. So, here's some of the reasons that I believe that it is valuable to help students become more aware of worldview issues. Well, let me open it up just for input from you for a minute here. Why else would you see value in educating our students to become more aware and to think about what we consider worldview issues? Or maybe you want to push back and give a negative to doing this, becoming more, helping students become more conscious of assumptions and so on. Any further input here?
I can see it would be helpful in engaging with people of a different worldview. As I watch online discussions about such things as abortion and animal rights, you can tell people aren't connecting at all.
They're just talking past each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One way that could possibly help to study other worldviews is to be able to relate and then refute with other people, like if you're extra geek or something like that. And if you know how these people think, sometimes it can help, you know, find the weak spots where they're coming from, doesn't line up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And just being able to kind of get a glimpse into how someone else thinks things, mm-hmm. very easy, you know, help with different cultures and live through private schools and whatever, to not even be able to comprehend how completely opposite and foreign other people think.
Yeah, sure. That made me think about how some people use worldviews. You get this really sharp wit or brain that gets good at worldviews and go out and sort of just slash and burn everybody that disagrees, or just in a very adversarial way. And I think that we should remember and help our students see that that's not the purpose of understanding what somebody's assumptions. It's not to become this really good debater and just embarrass other people with how sharp you can be intellectually. But that's not to say that there's not value in understanding them. But we just need to have compassion and love along with it. Yeah.
One reason I think about, and it somewhat depends on what circles religion probably too, but you know, we're human, and yes, we study the gospel, we try to have a comprehensive Christian worldview, and yet there's times we need to adjust our own worldview and realize, you know what, the way I'm looking at something is due to an assumption that really isn't quite according to the Bible, or isn't like quite the way I should be looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the other reason I think probably we should try to help our students understand that there is basic assumptions behind our beliefs. And analyze those and say, are these right?
Yeah.
Are these according to the Bible?
Okay, good. Be humble enough to be self-critical and self-evaluating.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are behaviors we'd like to see change in other people. And at least for myself, it can be easier to do that in a roundabout way and realizing that this really doesn't match with what I say. I believe in a worldview understanding. Understanding what those assumptions are can help me make the connection myself. And maybe the same with students. And also, you mentioned the plug-in mentality. I think students often have that. They don't realize a lot of the things they are enthralled with are simply something other than this reality.
Yeah, competing systems that work in their lives. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Perhaps this would be a summary after the three on the board, maybe, but just to prevent our students from being so vulnerable to every charismatic person that comes along with a great song and dance or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. And the ability to see through.
Okay, good. I'd like to make a note here that point out the limitations of worldviews studies at the same time that we're pointing out their value. There are some proponents of worldview studies that would seem to say that if we can get people to ascribe to a certain ideological framework, this Christian worldview, then that's being Christian. Okay, and that's what we have in education. That's what we're about. We're about training students to believe a certain set of ideas. And then that's we've achieved our goal. Now they're Christian. Anybody heard of Summit Ministries? David Nobel. But I think that we recognize, as Anabaptists, there's lots of other people that also recognize that Christianity is not just that. That's not even the essence of Christianity. Christianity has a worldview, but it is not merely a worldview, not a certain framework of ideas. But that at its essence, that it's Christianity is trust and surrender to the person of Jesus Christ. And that's not merely an intellectual exercise. So I believe in doing some worldviews, but not making that the essence. There's also the recognition that we're not merely minds walking around. We're not just thinkers. We also, what we love, what we're committed to, what we choose, is another part of the picture. If Desiring the Kingdom, James K. Smith. If you want to see kind of a pushback against education and worldviews as sort of being the all in all in Christian education. And also, it's not a completely conscious process. What we do, our habits, our rituals, our practices form who we are. It's not that we just decide what we're going to believe, and that simply is a one-way street to our attitudes and behaviors. There's a feedback. It goes both ways. Okay, I'd like to talk about a couple different approaches that you could take in the classroom to worldview studies or engaging with your students and in worldviews issues. One would be you could take a systematic approach in which you would identify some of the, it was the wrong button, categories. Some of the main worldviews or categories of worldviews that are prevalent in our world. Christianity would be one. Islam, you could say, is another major category of worldviews. There's different ways you can slice this up, but some people would just say materialism, and that could be, and then secular humanism, postmodernism could be a subset of materialism, or you could divide it up, and New Age. Another one that you see quite a bit of we're exposed to currently in our current climate. And then take different categories of reality and say, what are the assumptions that each of these worldviews has about the questions that these categories address? So epistemology, how do we know what's true? How do we know what's real? How does Christianity answer that question? How does Islam answer that question? How does New Age? And so on. And really break it down in just a very systematic way. There's a danger doing this is that it's overly simplistic in one hand. It's hard to find a person who fits. When you interact with people that just fit neatly in one of these categories, it's often kind of a mixed bag. People are a mixed bag of beliefs and values. But it does help students start to help them be more analytical, I think. The question of, is there a right or wrong? How do we know what's right or wrong? What's the basis of morality? Those are the questions that ethics addresses. What does A, B, C, and D say, and how do they answer those questions? And so these are some of the categories you could use: epistemology, theology, ethics, psychology. What's the nature of the mind? What are human beings? Here's a few more you could go through: sociology, history, biology, economics, aesthetics. So that would be more of a systematic approach to reviews where you would, I'm going to talk in just a moment about different forms in which you could take this approach. But this is one approach. The other approach would be to just try to take a more integrated approach, where you would simply be alert to opportunities. I mean, any class or any part of school life in which you could lead the students to dig beneath the surface of something that we encounter in the classroom or what's happening in our world, and examine the assumptions that inform and shape that experience or that action. So here are some forms, just some ideas of where you could or how you could bring these into your classroom. You could teach a class, would be one way to do it. In our school, we have a one semester a class which we teach worldviews. It's when we use it in the Bible, we call it a Bible credit. You could take a series of just some talks or activities for devotional time throughout the year in which you would examine some of these issues. One time a week, have a current events discussions. It could be in history class. It could be during your devotional time. Any time in your day where you have a place that you could fit in, just they have a regular time to have students bring in articles, current events, or you bring in things that are happening in the world, and you conduct a discussion, lead a discussion on those events. You could incorporate some of these ideas into English class, use essays or research papers on some of these topics. Okay, moving on a little bit now to methods. This overlaps a bit with what I had before, but some specific methods you can use whether within those particular forums that we talked about, whether it's in a class or in a devotional time or in a history class discussion. So use a current event or a provocative question. Essentially, that the little video clip we watched was a provocative question. It simply raised an issue, an idea that was provocative. It provoked ideas, provoked discussion, and used that as a platform in which to practice. We kind of do two things at once. You not only try to form a more Christian response to that particular issue, you also practice doing that, practice in a certain approach to issues, which then hopefully will train students to do that on their own throughout life. With current events, you can ask the questions of what's driving the action in this story? What's driving the characters, whoever is a character in this news story? What are the values or assumptions about life that are producing fruit here? I remember last year we during our Worldviews class, one morning I pulled up the news headlines, and there was Robin Williams hangs himself was a headline. And so we used that as a time to talk about what was this very, I don't know that much about it, about Robin Williams. He was a Hollywood comedian, somebody who had roles in quite a few films and was a popular character in Hollywood and in the entertainment industry. What's going on that, in terms of his purpose in life, his value of life, he gets to the place where he hangs himself? So it was an opportunity to ask some questions about the meaning of life and what worldviews, kind of a worldview, led him to that particular action. Another interesting question is why are people even paying attention to this? Why is this newsworthy? What is it that the media values or that the consumer values, the news consumer, that makes this a headline? And that reveals assumptions about our society. Just ask lots of questions as a method. I had this a little bit later, but it goes along with this. It can be effective to play the devil's advocate. You know, your high school students like to challenge, right? Like to ask questions. Put them on the defensive, and make them defend their position. Pretend that you believe something that's not true, and argue for it, and see how well they do at defending or answering the arguments that you throw at them. A project that you can do is what I call an overview project, where you would make a poster, or have the students make a poster for each of the major worldviews. So here's the students supposed to make a poster for the Christian worldview. And on that poster, they identify the major assumptions of the Christian worldview. They maybe include some pictures that would illustrate the values or the perspective of the Christian worldview. And then do that for each of the worldviews as a way of illustrating and kind of helping them define in their minds what each of these worldviews stands for. You could also listen to talks and debates by thinkers, people like J.P. Moreland, Robbie Zacharias, Wayne Craig, or Tim Keller, and there's a lot of other people that you can listen to and then have some discussion around those talks. Yeah, I mentioned play the devil's advocate. Cartoons are really good at encapsulating a certain viewpoint or worldview. Just a political cartoon or more of a worldviews cartoon. And that's some person's commentary on society, commentary on people. And then you can analyze the cartoon. Well, what is the cartoonist saying? What are his assumptions? And so on. My students have enjoyed doing something I call a profile activity, and in this one I asked them to create a person that's sort of the epitome of each of the worldviews. So create this character who's a Christian, and they're required to draw a picture of this person and create a biography, invent a biography, a history for this person. Talk about what they do in life, and so on, as a way of trying to put flesh on, try to get them to think about, well, if a person has these assumptions, what does it look like in the flesh? What does it look like in daily life? And then create this person who is modeling those beliefs and values. And what is the perfect secular humanist look like? What's the quintessential Muslim look like and do, and what are their goals in life? Another activity that can be done, and again, these can be done within a class and worldviews or just as part of a separate something that you integrate into another class or just an activity in the classroom. You can split the class into small groups and assign them a worldview. You would have already had to have talked about and introduced worldviews and what these different worldviews said about the world. And then get them to respond to various hypothetical situations. So there's this guy at work. My coworker is really annoying. And he just comes over and interrupts my work and just talks endlessly. And I get really frustrated at him. You know, what should I do about that? And so if all of y'all are Muslims, what are y'all going to tell me? How are y'all going to advise me to respond to that situation? And if all of y'all are New Agers, what are y'all going to say I should do about that situation? How should I respond to that person or handle my own frustration? Okay, and so it helps students to think about, well, if you believe this, how would that look? What would that look like in daily life? Another thing that can be done is a time analysis project where students keep track of how they spend all of their time for an entire week or period of time, and then say, well, based on that, what does that show you value? And get them to analyze how they're investing their time and what that reveals about their own beliefs and values. Credo project, simply where you would give the students a list of questions or at least a list of categories and ask them to articulate their own beliefs in response to those questions or categories. I do this as a sort of a final project in the Worldviews class that we have at our school, and I give them a list of questions. Do you believe in God? What is God like? Do you believe there's a right and wrong? What's the basis of right and wrong? What's the the most reliable source of truth, and get them to articulate their own, and there's a fairly summarized response to each of those questions or categories. I think I'll stop there, and that covers the material that I had on the handout and in my session. I considered doing another little mock-up session where we do an activity together, but we're basically out of time, so I think we're just going to stop there. I do want to open it up just for response from you. Perhaps you have additional ideas in relation to how to engage students, either forms for doing that or methods for doing that, things that you've done or have thought about doing. You want to share with the class?
Yeah. Do you have good resources for looking at the backgrounds of all these different theologies?
I do have a few listed on your at the very end of your handout. That would be a start. The Universe Next Door is a book that Sarah goes through and does examine. Different worldviews, kind of one by one, and talk about the different assumptions and beliefs in each one. Some of those other ones there would do that to an extent. You know, other, I'll come to Faith Builders and take Steve Brubaker's worldviews class. I end up, without even hardly realizing, I'm sure, drawing quite a bit from that, from my own time there. Maybe others have sources they can think about that they'd like to mention here. Okay, anything else? Another response? Okay, well, thank you. You are dismissed.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.